This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Donald Trump understands how politically potent the fear of the other is. From his announcement that he was entering the race for president till today, his campaign against immigrants has been the centerpiece of his administration. To discuss the human implications of his policies, we are joined today by an associate professor of cultural anthropology and research fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton, Dr. Miranda Cady Hallett. And because we are being recorded today, there are no opportunities for calls, but with just a conversation. Welcome to Cincinnati Edition. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I want to begin with just a very straightforward question. Does the United States, or any nation state, have the right to control its borders?
Yeah, absolutely. And to a certain extent, we have an obligation to have oversight over the borders, right? Because there is an opportunity for some chaos there, for some abuse of the confusion between two different legal jurisdictions, right? So absolutely, we have the right to control the borders. But what we don't have a right to do is to deny the right to asylum of asylum seekers who come to our borders or who apply for asylum within the country. So that's a really well-established right, not only within international human rights frameworks, but in our own domestic policy.
Yes, I want to stress that and on Monday, we had other people from the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton here on the show, and we talked about this a bit. But asylum is something that's protected both in international law with the Universal Declaration of Rights, but also in domestic law. So it is there. It's American law too. And what does asylum mean legally? Who has a right to asylum?
So asylum is essentially identical to refugee status. So the refugee framework was established in the aftermath of World War II after the great tragedy, not only of the Holocaust, but of the refusal of numerous countries, including the United States, to take in refugees, Jewish refugees mostly, who were fleeing from Germany in the years leading up to the Holocaust. And the intention of this framework, which saw it's really embedded in the 1951 Convention on the Rights of Refugees, is to provide protection for people who are fleeing from persecution from their own government. And so to prove your case as an asylum seeker, you have to prove essentially the identical thing that a refugee has to prove, that you're fleeing from a very well-founded fear of persecution on the basis of your political opinion or on the basis that you belong to a social group that's being targeted by your government.
So something like a group of people like the Rohingyas.
Exactly.
Are persecuted for who they are, not for anything that they have done specifically, mm-hmm. but for who they are. So let's take a look at some of the policies that the Trump administration has implemented, and their general sort of umbrella is zero tolerance policy has been the announced policy with some movement back and forth as to what that means. But some of the specifics, and I want to get your reaction, the child separation policy of the past spring and summer mm-hmm. was probably something that struck people very hard. So what's your view of that from a human rights point of view, legal point of view, cultural anthropologist point of view?
Sure. So the family separation crisis, it came as a surprise to a lot of U.S. citizens, I think. But for those of us who'd been watching the situation, it wasn't a surprise at all. So as early as December 2017, there had been reporting in the New York Times about the fact that the administration was considering this policy. Even earlier than that, we'd had hints, those of us who are monitoring kind of the shift in government policies around these issues. I had been looking closely at the Obama administration's policies, for example, their rapid expansion under Obama of the detention of mothers and children. When Obama came in, there were less than 100 mothers and children being held in immigration detention facilities in the U.S. at any given time. He ramped that up to an extreme degree, over 4,000, creating bed space for over 4,000 mothers and children. He was challenged in court that he could not legally maintain children incarcerated for that long. And that lawsuit was found to have merit. And so the Obama administration stopped holding children for over 20 days. And they left that kind of dilemma to the Trump administration. The Trump administration wanted to lock up the parents of children. Increasing numbers of families were crossing the border and have been over the last 5 years. And the administration wanted to incarcerate the parents, but couldn't do so if they were accompanied with children. And that led to this decision to separate the children. In my view, and not just my view, but really there was a report that came out at the end of September that was from the Department of Homeland Security itself, the Office of the Inspector General there. And it pointed out all kinds of problems with the way that zero tolerance policy had been implemented. The government was negligent in their handling of data. They deleted information that showed the link between parents and children, making it extremely difficult to reunite them afterwards. And they made public announcements saying to asylum seekers, don't cross between ports of entry because your children will be taken away from you. Go to a port of entry and turn yourself in. At the very same time, they used a practice called metering, restricting the entry of asylum seekers at ports of entry. And this was an extremely contradictory situation where asylum seekers then were going to ports of entry, trying to turn themselves in, and they'd be turned back multiple times and being forced to wait, you know, days, sometimes weeks. Now the wait time is up to months in the very dangerous cities on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border. And obviously that creates a very desperate situation for many refugees and a humanitarian crisis, really, that affects not only the migrants, but also residents of border communities and makes them all much less safe.
What about the policy of mass incarceration of unaccompanied minors? These are young people, various ages, who are coming across with no parent, and the numbers here have swelled as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So unaccompanied minors and family groups, parents traveling with small children, are both demographic groups that have increased quite a bit over the past 3 to 5 years. So even the Department of Homeland Security, for example, this summer during the family separation crisis, were saying, you know, we are getting more and more numbers of these kinds of border crossers, such that Border Patrol is apprehending now 40% of the people that Border Patrol apprehends are either unaccompanied children or families traveling with small children, not much fewer adult men, right, and many more of these kinds of groups. Now, that in itself indicates that this is a flow of refugees. This is displaced persons, right? You don't take your toddler marching for thousands of miles if you're not doing so out of desperation, right, out of the necessity of survival. And in response, right, the numbers and the combination of this increase in numbers of families fleeing with the very closed and harsh immigration enforcement policy has resulted in ballooning numbers of immigrants locked up. At one point, there were over 10,000 children being held in ICE custody. Now, and some are being held in very poor conditions in tent cities and so on.
And they've really restricted the ability to place those children with families, with agencies, with whatever, and distribute mm-hmm. them. They're keeping them on the border.
Exactly. So legally, the government is supposed to, as rapidly as possible, look for adult sponsors who are either their responsible guardians or someone else who can be responsible for the children. But they have put procedures in place that actually deter people from coming forward to claim their children by using the information that they get from potential sponsors to in immigration enforcement actions against those potential sponsors.
I should have asked you this when we were talking about the child separation policy of parent and children. What's the latest number that you've heard of children who still have not been able to be connected back to their parents because their parents were deported? And there were no records kept of how to get in touch with them or all variety of reasons. Where do we stand with that number at this mm-hmm. point?
The last time I checked, which was a few weeks ago, it was over 200 children that still had not been reunited with their family members. And as I mentioned, that's due largely to mismanagement and irresponsible actions on the part of the administration. And in addition to that, there are still children being separated. So there was a really great article in The New Yorker in October talking about a child who had been separated in July after the executive order supposedly ending family separation. But in this case, the child came with her grandmother. And so she was separated on the basis that she wasn't with her parent. And in spite of the fact that ICE and DHS knew exactly where the parent was, the parent called them, asked to be reunited with the child was kept detained until October. And that was – it took them that long to reunite this 4-year-old child with their parents. And I think that's just appalling.
I know you've had quite a bit of experience with El Salvador from looking at your bio. But one of the other policies that I think has floated under the radar sometimes is the effort to end temporary protected status for people from El Salvador and Nicaragua, and in preparation to expel them from the United States. Does this fit into this larger picture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are around 200,000 TPS holders in the United States from El Salvador. There are many more from Honduras as well. Nicaragua had the status for a while. And it does appear that the administration intends to terminate TPS status for all of these national origin groups. And something that a lot of people don't recognize about that particular community is that TPS holders, for example, from El Salvador, they had to have been present in the United States before January 5th of 2001 in order to be eligible for that status. So we're talking about long-term members of U.S. communities who have had legal permission to live here, have had a work permit, have been fully integrated, many of whom have U.S. citizen children. And it's just devastating for them to be told now that they have to go back to their home country, particularly when their home country is also in a state of a crisis of violence, right? And things are much more dangerous for them actually now than they probably were when they first left.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The United States has always been a powerful magnet, drawing those seeking a better life. Social and economic turmoil in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala has been a powerful force pushing people to seek a better life. To discuss how those two forces have driven hundreds of thousands to risk their lives for a safer and better life, we are joined today by Dr. Miranda Katie Hallett, an associate professor of cultural anthropology and a research fellow at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton. I want to focus on conditions for a moment, and you sort of hinted at this in what we were talking about right before we took the break, that conditions in El Salvador, Nicaragua, which are really sort of unspooling at the moment, that there aren't stable societies, to put it mildly, for people to return to if they're expelled from the United States after TPS or if they are prevented from coming in. What's two questions? What's the responsibility of the United States in relationship to conditions in Central America? And secondly, what's the opportunity we might have to do something positive that would maybe change the push that I set up that is driving people to make these thousand-mile journeys to come to the United States?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So it's very much true that there is a crisis of violence that's unprecedented in El Salvador right now and in the other countries that you mentioned as well. And I'll speak to El Salvador simply because that's where I do my research. It's the area that I know the best. But from 2013 to the present, we've had more violent deaths in El Salvador than during the entire 12 years of the Civil War, 1980 to 1992. And a lot of our listeners might remember how brutal that Civil War was, right? And that it produced its own refugee flow at the time. El Salvador is now 10th worldwide in rates of internally displaced persons due to violence. That's right up there with Afghanistan and Syria, higher rates of internal displacement than Yemen. Just this weekend, the Archbishop of San Salvador said in a press conference that the country is one step away from being a failed state. So this process of corruption of public institutions has gone so far that it's really impossible for citizens to find safety. And it's a targeted violence. So some citizens can kind of carry on with their lives and try to cope with it. but others are being specifically targeted for persecution, and they have no choice
Why?
But to flee.
For what reasons are they being targeted?
Some of it is gangs. So there are the famous MS-13 gang, the 18th Street gang, and there are also other more formal organized criminal groups that are drug trafficking organizations that are actually operate at a larger transnational level that are operate almost like local government in some areas. They have so much domination over social life that they charge rent, essentially tax-like extortions. They run protection rackets, and they control who can come in and out of these neighborhoods. On top of that, and in response to that partly, the government has taken this very aggressive approach to policing, where they send combined military police teams into poor neighborhoods like they're going into a war zone. And they round up young people in those neighborhoods indiscriminately. They imprison them, sometimes torturing them. So it's a combination of different persecutors. So in some cases, it's the gangs. In some cases, it's forces of the government itself. In other cases, paramilitary or parastate death squads. So the deterioration of the situation is such that many people despair of being able to not only have, you know, improve their situation economically in El Salvador, but just survive, right? So I think the phrase for a better life, for many people, it's to have a life at all that, mm-hmm. that they are fleeing. Now, it would be remiss of me to talk about this situation of chaos without mentioning the U.S. involvement in destabilizing the region initially, right? And I know that we just held the funeral of George H.W. Bush, former president. And indeed, he was instrumental towards the end of his tenure in trying to pressure the Salvadoran government to reduce their human rights violations. I don't want to take that away from him, but taken as a whole, the Reagan-Bush foreign policy in Central America was devastating to the region. It fostered the human rights abuses that racked the region in the 1980s and that continue up to the present.
So is there any sort of opportunity to change that dynamic, recognizing that we as a nation, the United States as a nation, had a role in creating the current situation? Even the exportation of the gangs that we're talking about are mm-hmm. American gangs that could export it back to Central America. Given that, and I think of something that former President Vicente Fox, who has family roots in Cincinnati and visited here several times, told me one time. He said, make no mistake, people coming here would rather be home eating tamales and enchiladas than eating hot dogs and French fries.
Mm-hmm.
And so what could the United States do in Central America that might change the dynamic at this point?
Well, I definitely think there are opportunities. The situation is not intractable, and there are many, many Salvadorans working so hard and, you know, to maintain their integrity in the face of the situation of rampant corruption, to fight to recover the rule of law and to establish good conditions there. You know, I continue to go to El Salvador and I take students there because there's a lot we can learn from Salvadorans and their resilience in the face of this crisis. So there's a big opportunity to support the positive forces of change in El Salvador by using evidence-based knowledge regarding positive social policies, prevention policies that can stop youth from joining gangs in the first place. I would like to say, however, that I think the first order of business is really for U.S. citizens to put pressure on our own government to make sure that we are upholding human rights here at home. And in that regard, to make sure that asylum seekers from Central America get a fair hearing in asylum courts, right? That's all they want is to have a chance to plead their case and not to be pressured to drop their case.
What's your perspective on how the courts themselves, I mean, there's the Trump administration policies, but what about the courts? How are they responding to the process? Have they changed in relationship to this administration's policies, do you think?
Well, it depends on what courts you're talking about. I don't know if you're talking about the immigration courts.
I'm talking about the immigration courts.
So the immigration courts are a peculiar beast because they are not independent from the executive. They're under the Justice Department. So I think the courts, the immigration courts to a certain extent have faced greater constraints under the Trump administration. Judges' discretion has been taken away, their discretion to give humanitarian relief to particular clients that come before them, for example. Immigration judges have been given a quota of 700 cases per year, which is impossible to do fairly, I feel, right? You can't – here's a life or death case for a person in half a day. You need the time to really consider all of the evidence. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's plenty of resources if the resources were allocated properly. If instead of throwing money towards, let's say, sending troops to the border, the government spent some money on reallocating funds for more asylum officers and more immigration judges, you know, a lot could be done to actually eliminate the backlog of people waiting for asylum at the border and give them a fair and swift hearing.
I want to take up one more topic, and that's many people worry that undocumented immigrants are a drain on social services, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's education systems, school systems. What's your reaction? And we have about a minute and a half left.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the case at all. I think we're really just in a moment of anti-immigrant backlash that's not based on any rational threat, either a national security threat or a criminal threat or a resource threat that immigrants pose to the country. I think we're very capable of absorbing this, the amount of immigrants that are coming. You know, border crossing is actually at one-third the level it was in 2006. It's back down to the levels we haven't seen since the early 1970s. There's not a crisis of numbers. There's a crisis in terms of how we're handling the situation. I was speaking last night with a friend of mine who went through the asylum process with his family, a Salvadoran man who is actually an ex-police officer. That's a lot of the people who are fleeing now is people who are fleeing corruption in the police forces. I asked him, you know, what he wanted people to know. And he said, we want you to know that we're good people, that we're coming here to make a difference, that we're fleeing for our lives, and that there are many people now who are detained that need the support and the solidarity of U.S. citizens and residents on the outside. We need to struggle and fight for them and for their right to survive. And he said, you know, he said he was a little bit afraid of speaking out and sharing his words through me. But he said he felt obligated to do that because as someone who's gone through the same process, he needs to be in solidarity with them.
Well, I'm glad you were able to cite him. And very quickly, there are some things happening at the Human Rights Center at the University of Dayton. You can find that on our website. I want to thank Dr. Hallett for being with us today.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.